Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Procter & Gamble in January started a campaign spinoff from its Gillette, the best a man can be tagline launched 30 years ago. The twist involved promoting what that means today. Times have changed, and with that, how we raise our boys.
Because we believe in the best in men.
Men need to hold other men accountable.
Smile, sweetie. Come on.
To say the right thing. To act the right way.
Bro, not cool.
Some already are. In ways big.
Yo, men, for everyone.
And small.
I am strong.
But some is not enough.
It's not how we treat each other, okay?
Okay.
Because the boys watching today will be the men of tomorrow.
Today we're talking about the notion of traditional masculinity and how growing up that way is detrimental to the overall well-being of American men. That's according to the American Psychological Association Guidelines for Psychological Practice with Boys and Men. Joining us by phone is a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues at the New York Times, Susan Chira. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also by phone, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Akron, former APA president and co-editor of the APA volume, The Psychology of Men and Masculinities, Ronald Levant. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
You know, I found even more interesting than the Gillette branding commercial was the feedback, the pushback by a lot of, I assume a lot of men. It's hard to tell from the comments exactly who it is always, but a lot of them, and one of them, Daz Rat, wrote 3 days ago, "Those who believe masculinity in males is toxic are the real problem." Susan Chira, just give me your sense about what kind of pushback there's been since this thing went live in January.
Yeah, well, it is fascinating, as you point out. I mean, what we saw is a lot of social media furor, lots of thumbs down on Facebook, you know, that far outweighed the thumbs up. That is not a poll. You know, some prominent celebrities like Piers Morgan or James Wood, the actor, were sort of threatening to boycott Gillette products and saying that they found it offensive. You know, I think there were also there was also praise and a sense that the commercial was trying to highlight, you know, ways in which men would act in a moral way. I mean, I think that even traditional conservative men, what interests me is that what this shows is men stepping in to prevent catcalling or bullying or you know, other actions that most people don't approve of, whatever their political affiliation. But I think they were saying that they felt that somehow the commercial cast all men as bad guys, and then, as I'm sure the professor will tell us, with the APA guidelines, the idea that there is some kind of perceived attack on the role of a traditional man as a protector, as a source of strength, and this appears to be enraging and annoying to some sector of the public.
Ron Levant, what do you make of the criticism? Now, granted, as Susan made the point, this is not a scientific survey, but it is something.
Oh, yeah. It definitely is something. There are a couple of aspects to it that I'll comment on. Some of the criticism stems from a lack of understanding, kind of a confusion that somehow masculinity, which is kind of a role and a set of behaviors, a set of norms for how boys and men are supposed to think, feel, and act, is synonymous with being male. And in psychology, we've long made a distinction between sex, that is male or female, or in between, and gender, which is essentially a set of learned role, a learned role, a set of learned behaviors that, occurs during childhood when children are socialized into a particular gender role. And what we were saying, so some of the people thought when we criticized, and our criticism is based on 4 decades of research that show that scales that measure traditional masculine constructs are associated with a wide range of harmful and negative outcomes for the men, for their families, and for society at large. So, you know, what we were essentially saying is, we're trying to send a message to society at large is reconsider how you raise your son. Do not force them to conform to what we consider an outmoded set of standards for what it means to be a male. I think the most harmful thing you can do to a boy is prohibit him from crying. Mm-hmm. You know, all genders have tear ducts. if nature didn't expect us to cry, why would they give it to us? And there's a meme going around that showed a small boy, 8 to 10 year old boy, slumped on a stairway, and the caption said, "If this boy had been comforted rather than shamed for his sadness, there'd be one less angry man 10 years from now." Mm.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You know, another comment that seemed to have, there was a pattern of these as well. Susan Chira, in response to the Procter & Gamble branding ad, was that someone had said that that no human being is perfect, and that it's nice to have these aspirations. But they said the question is, why is it okay to bring out a film which negatively stereotypes men when there would never be an equivalent film targeting women? And this equivalency thing kept coming up. I don't know if you saw it, but it struck me that all of a sudden this wasn't about men, it was about women. And there were a lot of people saying, my mom beat me when I was a kid, blah, blah, blah. You know, what did you make? Is it a false equivalency? I mean, what do you make of that?
I mean, of course, there are mothers who imposed on their sons these rigid ideas of masculinity. But I do think it's, you know, why am I utterly unsurprised that something that primarily has to do with the responsibility of men gets put on the responsibility of women, that this is like a historical
shock theater, USA, right?
Right. but I mean, of course, you know, women as mothers, as wives, as sisters, grandparents, grandmothers, you know, they all play roles in shaping societal expectations and imposing them. I think this was a commercial aimed at men who tend to shave their chins. So, you know, I think that was their intended audience. But, you know, this is, it's ever thus, right? Women get blamed for many things.
Ron LeVan, what do you make of that? That tendency to kind of react as it's, if it's another gender battle?
Well, I think that goes to the second point that I was going to make earlier, you know, about the nature, where is this kind of pushback coming from? And one is, you know, as I said, is kind of a simple lack of understanding of the difference between sex and gender. The other is that, you know, adherence to traditional gender roles aligns very strongly with political ideology. There was a recent study shown that most Republicans tend to favor very traditional gender roles. You know, woman as homemaker, you know, parent, you know, husband as provider, protector. And whereas Democrats, you know, or people who, you know, identify with that party tend to have a much more flexible view of gender roles. And they view gender roles, women can be, you know, good providers. In fact, one of the studies that came out in the 90s showed that more than half of married women were bringing in over 50% of the family income. So, you know, we all know that story has changed. That horse has left the barn. So I think that part about alignment with political ideology and the fact that we are living in the most polarized era that I have ever seen, and I was born in 1942, I think is part of the pushback.
Why do you think, Susan Chira, that this conversation is reaching the public sphere kind of now? What I mean, is it just the whole Me Too slash Donald Trump slash, you know, whatever? Everything's much more public. Social media. What do you make of it?
I think it's a combination of all of that. I mean, I think first of all, Donald Trump's election was a, you know, all during the campaign, it was assumed that his the way that he frequently insulted and demeaned women, and then after this infamous Access Hollywood take where he talked about forcing himself sexually on women, this was all thought, oh my God, this is out of the bounds of political acceptability, the way he taunted female candidates and braided their appearance, et cetera. So he gets elected, and first of all, there's a kind of collective shock in some quarters that these ideas, which were associated with a kind of Mad Men era, were not politically disqualifying. And so, one, you had Trump as a kind of symbol of misogyny and antiquated ideas about women. And then you had the Me Too movement, which heightened consciousness of sexual harassment and assault, and showed how extraordinarily common it remained in all kinds of workplaces. You know, from Hollywood, I did an investigation with a colleague about decades of harassment on a factory floor at two auto plants in Chicago, where women were harassed and terribly treated. And so, you know, I think that also raised consciousness about their treatment and what role men should play in trying to remedy this. And I also think it aroused a lot of defensiveness and backlash, you know, and thus we saw the Kavanaugh hearings, where there was a sharp divide between those women who saw this as another woman like Anita Hill not being believed, and those women who saw this as a moment where their sons or husbands could be falsely accused by women out to get them. So, you know, they don't always fall in traditional gender divides. Women, there are women who support conservative roles, but you're absolutely right, Professor. You know, political scientist research has shown that those attitudes have tended to escalate by party. It wasn't always the case, but it is in this particular polarized moment, you also have the political combat that's ongoing. And in the middle of a, if I may, a already presidential election where six women are announcing running for president.
Yep.
And only one man is officially.
I mean, they'll catch up, but it's just intriguing.
Yeah, exactly. And just before I you know, before we move on, another comment from the page devoted to the Procter & Gamble Gillette ad. They write, toxic masculinity. 43% of boys are raised by single mothers. 78% of teachers are female. So close to 50% of boys have 100% feminine influence at home and 80% feminine influence at school. Toxic masculinity isn't the problem. The lack of masculinity is. Is there any substance to that, Ron Levant?
No, there's not. Because one of the primary socializers, you know, and enforcers of traditional gender norms are peers. You know, boys get bullied by other boys, and that was shown on the Gillette ad. You know, that, you know, yes, indeed, you know, men, the figures you quote are accurate. Men have abdicated in large measure parenting roles, but the socialization influences are not limited. As a matter of fact, there was this a very controversial study done a decade or so ago that showed that friendship and peer influences is more influential than parental. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say something about the hashtag Me Too thing, because I'm writing a book right now, which is going to be published this year by Oxford, titled Freeing Men from the Prison of Masculinity to Counter Sexual and Gun Violence. And I've been looking very deeply into the research on the relationship between various scales that measure masculinity and sexual and gun violence. And one of the things that's very clear, it's clearer for sexual than for gun violence, is that various scales that have been developed to measure masculinity are associated with rape myth acceptance. That is, the acceptance of the idea that women who are raped ask for it or brought it on themselves. In some studies where they've actually followed
the situation. It was actually associated with physical assault. So traditional masculinity, and we should define that term, because we don't actually use the term traditional masculinity. We use the term traditional masculinity ideology.
Hmm.
And what that means is we're talking about a set of beliefs for how boys and men should think, feel, and behave. And as I said, we've got scales to measure this. And there are seven sets of norms. One of it, which places a great deal of importance on sexuality. Another is to avoid all things that are feminine. The third is to restrict the expression of vulnerable emotions. The fourth is self-reliance. Then there's toughness, dominance, and disdain for sexual minority men. So these norms, you know, every boy and man has to contend with them at some level. What we found in our research is that most adult men tend not to endorse those norms very strongly, even though, you know, they've been subjected to them as children. But I think they find that these norms are unworkable and they can't live up to them, and they kind of accept themselves for who they are. And what we found is the adult men who still strongly endorse those norms their scores are responsible for the negative associations I mentioned, particularly with regard to sexual abuse and violence.
Huh. Susan Chiro, we have to say goodbye to you. I appreciate your time so much today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye now.
Susan Chira, senior correspondent and editor of Gender Issues at The New York Times. Also with us, Ron Levant. He's a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Akron, former American Psychological Association president and co-editor of the APA volume, The Psychology of Men and Masculinities. We will continue our conversation. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Traditional masculinity is harming men both physically and mentally, according to the American Psychological Association guidelines. They're called Psychological Practice with Boys and Men. And it's the first time the APA has published guidelines focused on men and boys. Still with us by phone, psychologist, former APA president, and co-editor of the APA 2017 volume, The Psychology of Men and Masculinities, Ronald Levant. Dr. Lise Elliott teaches neuroscience at Chicago Medical School at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. Her 2009 book is titled Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Trouble. Some gaps and what we can do about it. Lise Elliott joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you call the brain a unisex organ, I guess the idea being that there really isn't a pink or blue brain.
No, I wrote a book of that title, but sort of quickly discovered in my research that the brain is really no more sexed or gendered than the heart or the liver or the kidney. There are subtle differences, effects of hormones, et cetera. But I think the whole transgender movement is proving to us how much fluidity there is in gender, and that it's really more of a language that we learn from the first moment of life than it is something that's pre-wired in our brains.
It's something that's just immersive as a society, right? It's not like somebody sets out to genderize another human being.
That's right. I mean, there are subtle differences between boys and girls from early on, not really at birth, but within the first 3 or 4 months of life. By the end of the
second year, it's pretty clear boys are more physically active than girls. But these differences are really quite small, and it's impossible to predict for any individual boy or girl who's going to be the more social or the more active or the more verbal. My view is that there's tiny differences at birth, but then mostly gender gets magnified through our very different socialization practices.
And the socialization comes from where, Ron Levant? Where do we know about the psychology of men and masculinities and where it came from in the first place? Is it going back to, you know, the cavemen kind of a thing?
It doesn't. We don't have to go back that far, and I don't think we can. Before I answer that, I just wanted to respond to the last comment to mm-hmm. say that on the psychology side, we've been studying sex differences in psychological characteristics for, gosh, maybe 100 years. Mm-hmm. And lately, we've been looking at meta-analyses of these studies, which are statistical aggregations of many studies. And Janet Hyde, the University of Wisconsin, has kind of been the definitive authority on this. And one of her recent publications has looked at 46 meta-analyses encompassing thousands of studies and hundreds of thousands of participants, including both children and adults, and concluded that 78% of the psychological sex differences that were found were trivial or small, kind of affirming the speaker's last point, that most of these differences are small. The ones that are large, for example, women's marathon times change when the conditions change. Women's marathon times have gone down considerably in the last 40 years as many countries have set up programs to support women in that role. So mm-hmm. I completely agree with the comment. The thing you asked me is, where does socialization come from? It comes from an ideology that's extant in a given society that also has lots of variations, because we have lots of subcultures in the U.S. based on race and ethnicity and social class and sexual orientation and so on and so on. But by and large, you know, going back to just after the Second World War, there was what we call a traditional masculinity ideology. There's also a traditional femininity ideology. And that kind of view of how boys and men should think, feel, and behave was pretty much dominant at that time. In the 60s, the second wave feminist movement pushed back against it considerably, but it still is the dominant way of thinking about boys and men. And it influences parents. It influences other children who tend to be, you know, the chief gender police for boys. That is, boys police other boys. Boys who cry, as you probably know, get bullied. Boys who show any kind of characteristics that are considered stereotypically feminine, get teased or beaten. It comes from the parents. The father, at one time, was considered to have the role of modeling masculinity and heterosexuality for his sons. This was called the essential father hypothesis, but it's pretty much been debunked. And the young men I know who are fathers today, their parenting behaviors are indistinguishable from that of their wives. That basically is parenting. There's no gender differences in how you relate to children, at least among the younger generation.
Let's see. Nikki in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Nikki.
Yeah. This conversation reminds me of something I sometimes refer to as the John Wayne syndrome that we have in this country. You know, it kind of grows out of that myth of the old West of men, you know, have to be tough and nobody better mess with them or, you know, they'll punch him in the face or, you know, I hear every week, you know, there's somebody gets in a fight at some bar around here and somebody goes and gets a gun and they have a little gunfight like they're in some old Western movie or something. So, yeah, it's that kind of thing. We've been fed that. I'm 65, so we've been fed that since we were a kid, that's the way men are supposed to be.
Lise Elliott, is there, when you're talking about neuroscience, do you see how men's brains change over time and their response to these kinds of triggers? No pun intended.
Yeah. Well, we certainly see, you know, there are many, many studies reporting on sex or gender differences in adults, and generally they're more noticeable than they are in children, which you would expect as gender roles differentiate as children grow. But even there, you know, our basic circuitry is the same. You know, the way we process language and emotion and anger, at least at the level that we can see with MRI, which, you know, maybe is still at the 30,000-foot level, men and women have pretty much the same hardware. But when we get to subjective things, like if you, instead of looking at somebody's brain when they're responding to emotion or recognizing emotion, which you see almost no difference between men and women, if you ask men and women, you know, how they feel in an emotional circumstance, like, you know, put them through a mild pain stimulus, females will report greater pain than men will. And that's because we adjust our responses to fit gender expectations. So it's really very superficial. It's much more in the eye of the beholder or what one is trying to present than what you're genuinely feeling and thinking under the surface.
Yeah. Ron Levant?
Well, I wanted to kind of relate the gentleman's comment, you know, about the violence, mm-hmm. and, you know, and that progresses from, fisticuffs to gun violence, and kind of mention, I don't think it's already been mentioned, that one of the precipitants of this national debate we're having on masculinity was the American Psychological Association's guidelines for practice with boys and men.
Mm-hmm.
And what those kind of, they speak to the problem he's talking about. That is, you know, men who are depressed tend not to express it in the prototypical ways because the expression of sadness and vulnerability is considered feminine. And men tend to express depression in kind of a more active, what we call externalizing way, through irritability, anger, and violence. And they also tend to try to drown it out through alcohol mostly, but also other drugs. So we're now, you know, one part of these guidelines is to make psychologists aware that you may have a man in your office who doesn't necessarily meet all the DSM criteria for depression, but he gets into fights a lot, he drinks a lot, he, you know, this and that, and expressing a lot of rage, you know, consider that the possibility that underlying all that might be a depression and, you know, develop your treatment accordingly. So these guidelines, you know, are there to kind of help remediate the kind of problems the caller was talking about, you know, of men who, you know, get into these kind of fights and that progress to, you know, a gunfight.
You know, I'm kind of surprised that the APA's guidelines for psychological practice with boys and men, especially when it comes to that it was even necessary. I mean, weren't psychologists already aware of these issues?
Well,
the
probably many were, but the American Psychological Association is in the business of developing guidelines. That's part of what it does. And, you know, the APA is the largest association of psychologists in the world with about 130,000 members. And it's about evenly divided between people who are in practice and, you know, and people who are in academia like myself. And so, you know, they've developed guidelines like in 07, they developed guidelines for practice with girls and women. We have them for older adults. We have them for gays, lesbians, and bisexual and transgender folks. We have them for racial and ethnic minorities. And it's based on the research of the academic psychologists to kind of study, you know, kind of how different groups might respond both differently to a psychological disorder as well as to different treatment options.
And as I mentioned, you know, unless you happen to have kind of delved into it as a psychologist, you may not be aware that some men might be depressed, and yet they look very aggressive and kind of ornery and mean, and it's essentially covering over what is a major depressive disorder. So the guidelines are intended, they're aspirational, they're intended to inform practitioners, and their ultimate aim is to improve services to boys and men.
You know, Dr. Lise Elliott, does any of this inform us about whether medications should differ between men and women, given the way the different genders are socialized, or not necessarily because it's a unisex brain?
Well, certainly, you know, looking for sex differences in drug treatment is an important focus now of the National Institute of Health. You know, every clinical study must have an equal number of, or, you know, strive to have equal numbers of men and women. And even animal studies, we're now requiring researchers to look at male and female animals. I mean, I have some quibbles given the difference between sex and gender and the idea that what you see in a so-called depressed rat is going to be the same as a depressed male or female human. I think that's quite a stretch. But certainly, you know, it's important to look at drug effects in men and women separately just because, you know, we have different amounts of body fat. We metabolize drugs slightly differently. I think there's about a 10% difference in alcohol metabolism, for example. And so you have to look at each sex or gender separately. But that said, I mean, the basic arsenal of antidepressant drugs, there's no drug that is, you know, effective only in men or only in women. They really work, you know, the SSRIs like Prozac, or even the newer focus on a short-term acting drug like ketamine works as well in men or women. And psychotherapy, too, works as well in men and women, although given the social differences between men and women, and I'm not a therapist or clinical psychologist, but it's just pretty clear that a therapist is going to relate differently to a man than a woman because of the different societal expectations and kind of norms of conversation that we have with people. It's that gender is just so built into every social interaction. You can't really escape it, but you need to learn to work with it and treat these boys and men who have generally been undertreated. I mean, women are always more likely to express vulnerability. They seek out all kinds of medical help much more than men. And so psychology and psychiatry is an area where men and boys have been largely undertreated, in my opinion.
Well, Dr. Lise Elliott, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Lise Elliott, she teaches neuroscience at Chicago Medical School at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. Her 2009 book is titled Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Also, Professor Ronald Levant, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me on.
Professor Levant is a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Akron, former American Psychological Association president and co-editor of the APA volume, The Psychology of Men and Masculinities. We are going to continue our conversation with somebody who studies the idea of masculinity. So stay with us and tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the concept of traditional masculinity and how, according to the American Psychological Association, it harms men and boys, both physically and mentally. The American Psychological Association last year published the first ever guidelines for men and boys to help address the socialization of masculinity that has caused the harm. Mary Himmelstein studies masculinity at the University of Connecticut. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In what ways or how has your research supported the idea that traditional masculine socialization causes these negative mental and physical effects?
Yeah, so my work really looks at what masculinity means in healthcare for reporting of health symptoms and for delay of care going to the doctor. And what I found is that the more that men sort of embrace traditional masculine values, that they have to be tough and brave in order to respect themselves, the more barriers they have to seeking medical care, and the longer they wait in an acute situation when they're ill or injured, and the less likely they are to seek preventive care. And then it also spills into what you say when you're in the doctor's office. So we know that men who really embrace these values also report their symptoms less consistently with male doctors relative to female doctors.
Why is that? They're just less comfortable opening up to a man than they are a female?
Well, so there's some research by Michael Kimmel to suggest that men are often the ones who are reinforcing values related to masculinity. And so the theory behind it is really that it's harder to be vulnerable with another man at the risk of losing status.
And the threat of losing one's masculinity, what do we know about what that feels like for men, boys?
Yeah, so I have some research to show that it's physically stressful, that when you're in a situation where you feel like your masculinity is being threatened or you're losing status related to masculinity, that men's bodies have a physical reaction to that, that you see changes in stress hormones and changes in heart rate to suggest a physiological stress reaction. And I think that's actually probably one of the ways in which we see masculinity really getting under the skin to impact other health problems down the road.
This is that toxicity we're talking about.
Indeed, yes.
Let's see. Janet in Bexley, you're on the air. Hi, Janet. Hello, Janet.
Hi, yes.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, I had a question how this kind of science is influencing education. And if schools of education are teaching teachers to look at gender more neutrally.
What, is there any research on that score, Mary Himmelstein?
I can't speak to my own research on education, but I know that certainly in the practice guidelines that APA has put out that educators should be more aware of differences in gender and in the classroom in terms of punishment. So we know from the research, for example, that when boys face punishment at school, it's much more likely to be harsh. And so that's problematic for a number of different outcomes, including academic achievement. And that's certainly one of the things that the guidelines are trying to address.
Why harsh? It's because the teachers are also socialized to think the boys are tougher and need a tougher correction?
In part, and also because often when we see problems in boys at school, we tend to see them more as externalizing, meaning they're behaviors that are really, really easy to pick up
okay. In
the classroom, whereas girls are more likely to internalize, and so certain problems can be missed. So it's basically like disruption in the classroom. It's harder to ignore.
Gotcha. Thank you, Janet, for that call. Chris in Asheville, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests could speak about this this really new trend called the baby movement, wherein a child is raised in a gender-neutral environment as though identifying as either as any sort of gender would be an imposition upon the child. Maybe they've heard of it. I just heard of it yesterday.
Well, I suppose, you know, there's people who, you know, I've heard for a long time about people who dress their kids in gender neutral garments, that kind of a thing. Mary Himmelstein, any insights on that?
I don't have any data on that specifically. I can say that gender socialization happens in all contexts. So even in a home where parents are raising a child to be more gender neutral, they're still going to get those messages outside of the home, particularly as they age into adolescence from peers.
Right. It as soon as you send them to school, you start to lose your grip. Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Then I wanted to get back to the medical impact of this toxicity Is this building up to cause these earlier heart ailments, the kind of the physical differences for men from their female counterparts, higher rates of death by suicide, higher rates of heart disease at earlier age, substance abuse, that kind of a thing?
Well, so we certainly know that it is causally inducing stress, which is contributing to all of those things.
Okay.
I certainly think masculinity is implicated in the disparities that we see between men and women, for sure, in cardiovascular disease, in suicide completion, and all of those things.
Is it subjective? Does it change from man to man? I think one of our other guests earlier in the program mentioned that most men grow out of the ideation of what the perfect masculine male figure is, and they adapt and find their own place in a continuum, and it's the ones who don't that have the problems.
Yes, exactly. So intersectionality certainly matters, and the way that we define what it means to be a quote-unquote good man is certainly going to be different based on culture, based on the social context, based on the contextual setting. So what one person might see as a traditional masculine value might be different depending on the context.
And what does that mean? I mean, have there been studies that compare and contrast the physical well-being of the ones who adjust and adapt and those who don't?
I don't know about the physical well-being for different forms of masculinity. There is a lot of research to suggest that there are multiple masculinities and that it does differ as a function of individual identities. I would imagine that it's probably harmful depending on the context, yeah.
You know, the guidelines that are put out by the American Psychological Association that sort of framed the conversation today, would they be different guidelines in a different country, in a different culture?
Well, so one of the guidelines is actually to pay attention to how masculinity is constructed and how it's different based on the social, cultural, and contextual space in which you are. So I think the guidelines would probably be similar in different countries, but I think one of the things that's important is on an individual basis with clients that psychologists and other professionals are taking this into account in treatment, that they're talking about how masculinity might be different from man to man and how it might be different in different groups.
Beyond the guidelines, where do you see this headed in terms of a national conversation and what's happening in conversations between psychologists and their patients?
Can you ask that a different way?
Well, I'm wondering how does it manifest in the real world? I mean, how does it change what's happening out there now for psychologists and their clients?
I think it's something that people are becoming increasingly aware of in sort of the real world context. I think it's something that we should be paying attention to, specifically intersectionality, and that it's not just a single identity that's influencing health, but that it's how your identities are coming together that's really influencing these outcomes. And I think there's been a lot of attention to that in the past 10 or 15 years, and I'm really glad that we're seeing that because it certainly does impact health, and I think it's important when considering that.
We talked earlier about the best a man can be, the best a man can get tagline that Gillette has used for its products for the last 30 years, and then their new reframing the issue with their new brand commercial that came out in January. And I was more fascinated than anything by the response from men to this, that sense of defensiveness that they feel about this. And then, of course, then comparing it to women, and women would never have to put up with a commercial like this and that sort of a thing. I mean, what do you make of that, the defensiveness piece?
I mean, I think for a lot of men, when we talk about masculinity, the idea might be that it feels like it's an attack. And I think it's really important to separate masculinity in general to sort of what we see in traditional masculinity and toxic masculinity, things that we know are harmful for health, as opposed to just what it means to be a good man, and how you construct that can be different. And it's not necessarily all bad, but I think when we talk about it, it can be very threatening, right? Because it feels like you're attacking what it means to be a man. And those definitions can certainly change.
Well, and some guys are thinking, hey, I've spent my whole life trying to live up to one ideation, and now you're switching gears on me.
Yes, exactly.
Well, what I mean, is that a part of being masculine, being defensive?
It can be in traditional masculinity, yes. So we know from research that one of the emotions that it's acceptable, that is a prescriptive or proscriptive stereotype for men, is that anger is an acceptable emotion to show, whereas sadness or other emotions are less acceptable, right? So I think the defensiveness makes a lot of sense, right? It's one of the emotions that it's fine to show, that you're not going to get dinged on for showing.
Yeah. And what about a hyper masculine type of personality who buys into all of the tropes? What do we know about how they raise their own children / particularly their girl children?
Well, I think in that sort of hyper masculinity, there is sexism that's embedded. And so I think that really goes into the socialization piece. And when you have a hyper masculine man who is raising their own child, I think they're going to instill those same sort of traditional values as well. And so you see that kind of intergenerationally, and it's harmful for both, I think, men and women.
Do women buy into it as much as men do? I mean, I guess it's everything's individual, but there is as much buy-in among some women to the hyper-masculine ideation as men, right?
There is, yes. But the extent to which women are enforcing it for other men is a little bit different. So you tend to get that status loss from other men as opposed to from women. Something that I think is kind of interesting that I think is related is that when you look at benefits of marriage, for example, you see men having more health benefits from having a marital partner than you see in women. And I think part of that is that you then have someone who is safe, who you can talk to about these other things, and you get that extra benefit of social support, whereas women tend to have wider social networks.
Right. Do you see anything changing demonstrably in our society? I mean, there's a whole nother generation of young people coming up that are living an altogether different situation than I did growing up. Does it matter?
So, and I think this is actually going to be a really fascinating topic to continue studying in the next 15 or 20 years, just because of the way that we're defining gender is changing, particularly in this most recent generation. And so I think this is going to be a hot topic going forward.
When you talk about the transgender piece of this, is it more it seems to me, and I could be completely wrong, I am female, it seems like men are more bothered by it than women are. Is there anything there that we can learn from?
That I don't have data on. I don't know whether men or women would be more bothered by transgender identities.
We just don't know. There just hasn't been that much. It's obviously pretty new.
Yeah.
Not the concept, but the larger acceptance of it.
Yes, for sure.
And the suppression, I mean, what kind of help you're saying that when it comes to that suppression, that's why men tend to be healthier in marriages, is because they don't have to suppress as much.
That's what I would think, that you have an extra person, you have social support where it's okay to be vulnerable in that relationship with your spouse, right? That's sort of my theory anyway.
Yeah. Well, Mary Himmelstein, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mary Himmelstein studies masculinity at the University of Connecticut. I want to say thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, and Sophie Warner produced this program, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. And Lynn DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.